Well, the more things change, well, you know what comes next. You can finish it in your head. The DeLorean is returning, for crying out loud. DeLorean Motor. There still is a DeLorean Motor? There is. It's based in Texas. DeLorean is resurrecting the past with plans to build replicas of the famed car from the Back to the Future movies of the 1980s. News out of Humble, Texas. This is according to the Detroit Free Press. Elisa Priddle, who's been a visitor to this program. According to the news out of Texas, DeLorean plans to make about 300 replicas of the 1982 DeLorean that's not been in production for 34 years. The company's remained in business by refurbishing the old cars, I guess. About 9,000 were originally sold. And it's described as a game changer for them by DeLorean CEO Stephen Wynn. You know what it is? It's the nostalgia that was stirred up on the 30th anniversary of the Back to the Future movies. It kind of makes sense if you think about it. It's current state here on Thursday for 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're here. Current State's been keeping you up to date on developments in Flint. As that city contends with lead-contaminated water, the Michigan National Guard is in Flint, helping distribute bottled water and performing other duties. Yesterday, we decided to check in with the Guard for an update on what's happening in the city. We caught up with Lieutenant Colonel William Humes, the public affairs officer for the Michigan National Guard.
We've been in Flint for, this is the second week. So we started officially 2 weeks ago with a presence in the fire stations. We just concluded on Sunday with a door-to-door mission that we spent 5 days canvassing the city twice. It's not just water, it's water filters, replacement cartridges, and test kits. And then we're transitioning to recycling efforts for all those bottles of water going out. So, but like I said, effective Sunday night, we transitioned out of the door-to-door mission. Now our sole mission for the Michigan Guard is continuing to support the 5 distribution sites at the 5 fire stations in Flint.
Are you hearing feedback about the Guard's efforts from the people of Flint?
Yes, so far, and I mean this sincerely and not as the public affairs guy, but honestly, it has been nothing but positive comments. There are daily check-ins. The Adjutant General, General Vadney, goes out at least every other day, and more times it's every day. But so he's out in Flint at the points of distribution. He was out to visit the door-to-door missions when that was taking place over the weekend. There are a wide number of vehicles to get the feedback, because we're very interested in that, right? The leadership for the Michigan Guard, we want to know, what's that reception like? Are we making missteps that need to be fixed? And going into week two, or as we start week three of the Michigan Guard support to operations in Flint, across the board, it's been positive feedback and thanks and a sense of calm, and we're grateful for that.
And, of course, Current State will continue to stay on top of developments in Flint, which continue to evolve. The water crisis there has truly become an international concern that's even caught the attention of the United Nations. Now, lead is among the heaviest known elements. When ingested, it can cause an array of neurological effects, from slurred speech to seizures and even death. Most cases of lead inhalation come from exposure to paint chips or lead dust. The Michigan National Guard's tackling the issue at more than 30 of its own properties across the state. Current State's Kevin Lavery visited one near Lansing and joins me now. Kevin, this is a different matter than the problem in Flint, correct?
Yes, absolutely. We had heard earlier that the National Guard in Michigan is providing relief to Flint residents, mainly at the water distribution sites. This program is separate. It involves more than 30 armories that the Guard operates across the state. Many of them used to have indoor firing ranges, but they were shut down about a decade ago. Still, some of the buildings have lead dust left over from bullets, and in the case of the Grand Ledge Armory, there may be some lead residue from mechanical equipment. Captain Delbert Avery is the Guard's state facilities manager. He showed me a large repair shop in Grand Ledge right next to a helicopter landing zone.
This used to be the aircraft hangar that used to support the aircraft activities of the Michigan Army National Guard. Since 2005, the construction of the air support facility right next door, this is actually their maintenance shop and their place where they can pull the equipment in out of the weather outside and pull the maintenance on it and do inspections as needed to make sure that they maintain their equipment.
Is this the main part of the building in which lead is most likely to appear?
It is not. What they're doing is they're going around the state and they are just taking samples from the armories, regardless of where it's at. They'll look at different areas of the armory from where the public has access, and then they also have where we used to have indoor firing ranges. I might be referring to those as IFRs. Those areas show the higher concentration, obviously, but through the process of remediation, we're eliminating those because we don't go through the process of using indoor firing ranges. The ventilation systems aren't up to code, the requirements that we have, and we have first-class facilities up in Grayling and down at Fort Custer to do those weapons trainings that we have to practice on every year.
This armory here in Grand Ledge never actually did have an indoor firing range, or it did?
It didn't when it was constructed. What they did have, though, like I was saying before, this used to support the aircraft maintenance. What they would do is they would take the weaponry off from the aircraft, bring it in the process of tearing down those weapons, the parts, and the cleaning of those weapons, the lead particles and whatnot would fall off from there, and they would have to clean up those areas as well. And we can go over to those areas and show you what those look like.
Sounds good. Let's go take a look.
As we walk through the facility, you're going to see places that potentially might trigger a response that, hey, we need to test this, like this light switch, for example. On top of it, there's a little bit of dust that looks like it's been there for a little while. That raises a question to me because of the state facility manager. I got to make a standard across the force that says every quarter we clean the light switches in compliance with the HUD requirements for lead dust removal for the safety hazards. But it could be as minuscule as that makes the entire facility hot. And those are the types of things that we don't want to do, is create that paranoia that it is an unsafe environment. But it's a real threat. So we are going through and making sure that we have everything identified first and getting together a process so that we clean it properly, handle it properly, notify properly, and continue service to the community. What we've done, though, is we've identified placards, so if public does come in, they're notified that, hey, there is a lead hazard here, it's known. Don't enter if you're pregnant, if you have small children, if you're breastfeeding or doing anything of the sort, because lead tends to affect the young and the pregnant much more than the normal adult. The adult can process the lead easier than what the developing child or the mother that's nursing the developing child or conceived child. So we're limiting access to the facility until we actually get everything down below that safe standard, and then we'll reopen the armory to that community again.
We're now standing in a corner of the building. This is a weight room. There's a lot of metal around us. What makes this room significant to the project?
It is a big industrial type space. And if you look up, there's bar joists, there's little ledges, there's industrial type piping through here. And if you notice on top of that piping, you see dust. Typically, none of that stuff is ever really tested, not really clean, because nobody really focuses on that. The concern there is once that stuff is there, that dust could have been there since the 40s, 50s, if the building hasn't been touched in a while. Those are the hot spots that would generate a lot of stuff, where dust can settle on top of old units and whatnot.
And again, as you mentioned, you could get into ventilation systems too.
That's exactly right.
We're talking with Delbert Avery, captain with the Michigan National Guard. We are at the Grand Ledge Armory. Has anybody recently been exposed to lead dust that would be prompting this cleanup?
I'm not aware of any such cases, but our intent is always to have a safe facility that they can come and they can utilize the facility. But from the standpoint of of actual cases, I can't venture to guess that.
What does it take to actually clean up lead dust particles, and will Guard soldiers do that, or will be contracted out to specialists in that field?
It depends. It depends on the level of lead that was identified in the test results. But what typically happens is it's a three-stage process, a cleaning process. If there's not a lot of lead dust identified in it, in its marginal levels, what we'll do is we'll identify where it's at. We'll isolate it to the room that it's in, because what we do is we get a whole report of the entire facility, and then we can narrow it down to, okay, it's room B, it's room C, and if there's a trend of seeing the dirty rooms, we'll look at other aspects of it from the standpoint of the air distribution, the air recovery systems, go through and look at every component of that to clean it, establish a plan. If it is to the level of where we have to get ductwork clean and get into the inner structure of the facility, like the distributions of that, we will contract that out. And the National Guard, we're working on securing statewide contracts to get that remediated at that level.
We're talking with Delbert Avery, captain with the Michigan National Guard. We are at the Grand Ledge Armory. When you think about lead exposure, often it's in a residential setting in big cities like Detroit with an old housing stock built before 1978 where you have lead-based paint. You think about windowsills and other friction points that create chips. But it's not always as commonly thought of or perceived to be a problem in the workplace. Is this something that really is on the mind of the average soldier as they're doing their daily functions, that this potential contaminant is around where they're working?
Well, like I said when we started out the conversation, these facilities we have across the state was a community-based facility that originated in the 50s, the 60s. So we're well within that benchmark of having lowered standards at that time, because we just didn't know what types of environments were out there that could be harmful. So these facilities are always on the minds of that, and soldiers are recognizing that when they walk up to the facility and they see all of these structures that have a cornerstone was built in 1953, and it raises the question, well, are we safe? Well, one of the things that we're doing as far as the construction process is when projects are originated, we identify the areas that we're going to restore, renovate. And before we even start the construction aspect, we look at all aspects of the hazards. We identify the asbestos, we identify the lead, we identify the radon, we identify all of these known hazards, and we minimize it and we try to reduce it from a standpoint of safe workplace, not only for the soldier, but then also for that construction worker that needs to come in and do their job.
Lead, of course, is a big topic in our state, and I wonder if the public will be looking at the National Guard, especially what's happening with the Guard's mission in Flint, and really scrutinizing what you'll be doing to clean up these facilities.
What is the National Guard supposed to be? We're supposed to be there for the citizens. Absolutely, we're expected to have the public scrutinize our activities, because if we're not there for them, who are they going to call on? So that citizen soldier is there because of the public. So the scrutiny is warranted, and it's understood. And this process has been an ongoing process for the last decade that we've been trying to remediate. We've identified these armories, and we're working through a plan to remediate all of those issues that makes the armory unsafe from a lead aspect.
Captain Delbert Avery is the State Facilities Manager for the Michigan Army National Guard. We've been talking about the campaign here at the Grand Ledge Armory and other armories around the state to get rid of, remediate lead dust. Thanks, Captain Avery.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And coming up on Current State, at Flint's Sloan Museum, a new exhibit tells the story of the city's water system all the way back to the first well ever drilled in the city. Current State Scott Pohl talks with the museum's Todd Slisher about the exhibit Water's Extreme Journey that's coming up. You've heard of improv comedy, and maybe you've even seen an improv performance, but chances are you've never seen anything quite like Broadway's next hit musical. The cast of this New York stage comedy essentially makes up musicals on the spot, and it's coming to East Lansing's Wharton Center tomorrow. Current state producer Katie Cook spoke with one of the cast members who happens to be a Michigander, right, Katie?
That's right. Her name is Katie Hammond. She's from Michigan, and she's been doing improv comedy for many years. She explained to me how Broadway's next hit musical works. Actually, she kind of showed me how it works. But we started by talking about some of the basics of improv comedy. With so many actors and comedians getting their start in improv comedy, I think improv is pretty widely known. But for those who don't know a lot about it, let's talk a little bit about how improv works in general. Like, there's the basic rule of yes and. Can you explain what that means exactly?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's different genres of improv. There's long form, there's musical improv, and then there's short form, which is probably the most widely known version of improv, which is what people see on Whose Line Is It Anyway. So that's when people say, I do improv, I think that's what the most common recognition goes to. But the basic rule of improv, the yes and, just means that because everything is being made up in the moment by your scene partners, you don't know what they're planning to do. They don't know what you're planning to do. So you have to work together to create something awesome and memorable and hopefully funny and hopefully charming. And the way to do that is by saying yes to your partner. And the and part of that is you're saying yes to their ideas and you're building on them. So instead of saying yes, but, or no, and, you know, it's just the most positive way to build something collaboratively, mm-hmm. which in improv is the only way to be successful.
So where does musical improv fit into the different genres? Is it more like long form or short form? Can it be both?
Well, it's the best kind, but it's also kind of one of the newer styles. Like Wayne Brady is probably the most famous musical improviser that's out there, and a lot of his success and notoriety is because of Whose Line Is It Anyway and because he's amazing. But he does a lot, from what people have seen, it's just like the quick, like, make up a song, you know, on the spot in, right. in a genre, in a style with like some words from the audience. Like that's kind of a short form game of musical improv. And then there's also long form musical improv where you make up an entire musical based on audience suggestions. It's a cohesive narrative storyline. What we do at Broadway's Next is the longer storytelling version of musical improv, where you get suggestions from the audience and you make up a song, a musical, really, and then you find a way to make a story throughout. And one of the great things about the show is it's family-friendly, which to a college campus doesn't necessarily sound super inviting, but what's so great about it is that when we're on the road, when we're in New York, you know, our audience is very loyal, and so we get the same people coming again and again and again because it's a show you can see 100 times and it's never the same.
Right.
But on the road, our audiences are the whole spectrum. So we get parents bringing their young kids and loving it, to people who are retired and just looking for something interesting to do. And because our comedy is clean and our comedy is tight, it appeals to everyone. And it's just a joy. Like I watch the show when I'm not in it, because we're a rotating cast.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not always the same people on the road. It's not always the same people. There's, you know, 10 of us that rotate through whoever's available to go to a certain tour.
Right.
And when I'm not in the shows, I'll go and watch them because it's just such a great night.
Tell me more about what Broadway's Next hit musical, like what happens during your show.
So Broadway's Next, what we do is kind of like the Tony Awards, only it's the Phony Awards. And so the first half of the show is the award ceremony. So we ask the audience to write down made up song titles on little slips of paper before the show starts, and those all go in a fishbowl. And then one at a time, we'll come out and present a nominated song. So like at the Tony Awards or at the Oscars, where you see a little snippet of, you know, the movie or the musical, and then, or you hear a song, and just to kind of give the audience a picture and an idea, a snapshot of like what that show is about, we do that also, only it's all made up. And we wear gowns and tuxes, and I'll come out and say, oh, I'm so honored to be here tonight to present this nominated song. And then I'll just randomly reach in the fishbowl and pull out a suggested song title. So they all should be made up. You know, the more out of left field the title, the more fun the show becomes, because it really does weigh heavily on the suggestions that we get, on how interesting and fun and like exciting the show feels. And so we will take the song title and then tell, make up the musical that that song came from. So if the song title,
what if I gave you a suggestion? Could you show me how it works?
Well, I could try. Sure.
let me think. Okay. How about Let's Go Walking on the Moon Together?
So I would pull out Let's Go Walking on the Moon Together.
Mm-hmm.
Great. So I would say, I'm so honored to be here tonight presenting this next nominated song, Let's Go Walking on the Moon Together. And the song, Let's Go Walking on the Moon Together, comes to us from the musical Heavy Feet. And the musical Heavy Feet is, of course, about the space program in its early days and the very first astronauts that wanted to go into outer space. And I play an astronaut, one of the first female astronauts in NASA, and I'm trying to convince my husband that this is a really great idea to send me into space, even though it's never been done before. And so in the scene where Let's Go Walking on the Moon Together happens, my character is trying to convince her husband to come with me, and he just doesn't want to go.
Okay, and then the music starts?
Almost. So that, well, yes, we have like underscoring, but then another actor will come and join me on stage, and we will improvise the scene that I've just talked about. And then at some point when the emotions are heightened, which is the whole point of musical improv, is that when the emotions get so heightened, you have to sing because talking just isn't enough anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would improvise that song.
Okay.
So in the first half of our show, that happens four times. We see four different song titles. We see four different worlds, four different show potentials.
Mm-hmm.
And then the audience picks the favorite. And then in act two, we improvise the entire musical that won the Phony Award. So you see the scene again. You hear the song again. You just see it within the context of the whole musical story.
Okay. Very cool. So are you going to sing Let's Go Walking on the Moon Together for me?
Well, not without a piano player. I don't think anybody wants to hear that.
I'm speaking with Katie Hammond. She's a member of Broadway's Next Hit Musical, which is an improvised musical comedy show that's coming to East Lansing this Friday. So, Katie, you're from Michigan. Where did you grow up?
Yeah, we moved around quite a bit. I was born outside of Detroit in Birmingham, and then we moved to Kalamazoo for a while. So I lived in Portage, and then my junior year in high school, we moved to Ohio, and then I went to college in Ohio, and then I moved to Chicago to study improv, because that's kind of, I fell in love with it in college and thought this would be a really fun hobby, and then I realized that it could be a profession, and it's not easy, and I'm not a rich person, but it's really my favorite thing to do.
And Chicago is kind of like the mecca for improv. It's where a lot of people go to train. What was it like learning improv there?
It was awesome. It's one of those things now where I've been doing it for so long professionally that looking back, I can't believe that I did some of the things I did. Like, I've done some really, really terrible, terrible shows that at the time I was so proud of. But it was really, I've studied with some of the greats, which sounds like so cheesy, but in the improv world, there are people that everybody knows, like TJ Jagodowski and Susan Messing,
yeah.
And they were my teachers. And
really?
I was so lucky to learn from them. And it's been so interesting because I spent almost 5 years in Chicago studying and performing. I was at I.O. and Second City and The Annoyance and The Playground. And then I had a quick pickup in Orlando where I improvised full-time at Disney World. And then coming from Chicago to New York was really interesting because the improv community here is so strong and it's so thriving, but it's much different. Like, the style is different, and the way people teach and approach improv is a lot different here. And so it took me like a year to kind of figure it out and try to figure out how to succeed in this community of people, because the talent's so high. You got to find the people you jive with, because improv is all about the team.
And you write musicals on the side, is that right?
Yeah, I am not currently working on anything, but I've written a couple musicals, one of which is good. And it's getting some press, which is, not anything like, ooh, look at this. But we've had success with it getting produced. There's a theater, it just got picked up by a theater in Sydney, Australia. And I just actually this morning got an email from the woman I co-wrote this show with about someone in Paris being interested in the show. So it's, you know, nothing major, and it's just a short one-act, really sad musical, actually, but has some comedic moments. But it's nothing like what I do day-to-day, which was why when it happened I was so surprised by it. But I'm really proud of the show. It's really wonderful.
I've been speaking with Michigan native Katie Hammond of Broadway's Next Hit Musical, which is an improvised musical comedy show from New York. Broadway's Next Hit Musical will be performing at the Wharton Center this Friday, January 29th at 8 p.m. Thank you so much, Katie.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you so much.
For Current State, I'm Katie Cook.
And coming up on Current State, we'll head to Grand Rapids to visit a community-based orchestra, which will be performing a world premiere tomorrow night. Current State's Jamie Paisley speaks with the music director of the Kent Philharmonic and the Florida-based composer of that world premiere trilogy for organ and orchestra. That and more after the break on Current State. That's Hank Horton and Chris Rollins performing How Insensitive on a Live Music Friday earlier this month. Tomorrow, we welcome back to Studio S a familiar name. Sally Potter books the shows at the 10 Pound Fiddle in East Lansing, and she's also well known as the organizer of the Midwinter Singing Festival. The festival returns Friday and Saturday at East Lansing's Hanna Community Center. Sally Potter performing and talking with us on a Live Music Friday tomorrow. We hope you can join us. It's Current State on WKAR. The causes and effects of Flint's water crisis continue to play out in the news. The Sloan Museum in Flint hopes that a new exhibit will help explain the history of Flint's water system, how it got to the condition we're seeing today, and what people can do to protect their families. Current State Scott Pohl talks with the Sloan Museum's executive director, Todd Slisher, about water's extreme journey. Slisher says work to bring the exhibit to Flint started long before the current lead contamination problem came to light.
The core of the exhibit, Water's Extreme Journey, is actually a national traveling exhibit that tours around the country, and it focuses on watershed issues and pollution and issues that people have with water. And we originally booked this exhibit over 2 years ago, before all of the problems started to emerge about Flint's water, and even and before all the, of course, all the lead in water issues. But when we heard about the water problems, we realized there was an opportunity here. We actually moved this exhibit up in our schedule. We swapped two exhibits, and we decided to use the exhibit to help educate the community and to spread the word about what can be done about the water issue, about the lead issue, and kind of educate people on the whole water crisis and steps that they can take to help or to prevent lead contamination or to mitigate it. So that was an opportunity that we saw, and so we built a lot of local components into the exhibit.
I want to ask you about the form of the exhibit. Someone who attends the museum and goes through the exhibit, it's essentially a maze. You're a water drop, and as you work your way through it, you're trying to stay clean. Is that the essence of this exhibit?
That's the correct. That's the traveling exhibit portion, the portion that's been going around the country. And yes, in that case, you are a water droplet, and you enter the water cycle. You fall out of a cloud onto land, and you go through a maze, and the decisions that you make in that maze, sometimes it's a random decision. You spin a wheel and find out what happens to you. Sometimes you have to make a decision, determines whether you stay clean or whether you get polluted. And if you get polluted, you get kicked out of the maze, and you got to start over again and see if you can find the quote-unquote clean path all the way through the maze. So the exhibit deals with issues of water runoff, of pollution from neighborhoods or cars. People don't know, even washing your car and sending the soap down the drain can pollute a watershed, or agricultural pollution, other ways that water in a watershed can get polluted. But that is the one component of the exhibit. There's a whole other half of the exhibit that deals with Flint's water issue. And we've worked a lot with local groups like the Flint Watershed Coalition, Flint River Watershed Coalition, it's kind of a mouthful, to work on plans in the exhibit to look at the health of the Flint River. We've looked at the timeline of the entire water crisis and when we knew what we knew. And a lot of people don't realize the Flint water situation has been going on way, way, way back, even around the turn of the century. There were all debates on how Flint should get its water and how we should work. So we've got some historical components to the exhibit as well.
Yeah, I understand it goes all the way back to the first well that was ever drilled in Flint.
Yes, exactly. There was a well that was drilled downtown, and it was to provide water for public and for horses at the time, for horse-drawn carriages. So that was the first well in Flint. But Flint has gone back and forth with different water sources over time, from wells to using the Flint River. And many people don't realize Flint has considered a pipeline to Lake Huron, the source that they will be switching to this summer, all the way back into the 20s and 30s. It was first considered doing something like that. So there's a lot of history of Flint's water situation as well.
We're talking with the executive director of the Sloan Museum in Flint, Todd Slisher. They've opened up a new exhibit on clean water. It's called Water's Extreme Journey. Does the exhibit include practical tips for people who are dealing with contaminated water in Flint right now?
Yes, it does. We work with Dr. Mona Hanna-Atisha, who's the doctor over at Hurley Hospital, the pediatrician that has been at the center of this, to develop some material in the exhibit and to give some practical advice. There are things that you can do, good nutrition, vitamins, and supplements that you can take to help try to mitigate the effects of lead, especially in children. But we, of course, are not medical professionals. We don't recommend a course of treatment. We would suggest that you see a pediatrician about that if you suspect that you have lead contamination or other issues.
The exhibit also includes an investigation of the condition of the Flint River over the course of time. The current perception, of course, is that the Flint River is in terrible shape. Am I right about that, that people learn about the condition of the Flint River over time?
Yes, they do. We have an entire section of the exhibit that deals with Flint River and the quality of Flint River water and the Flint River over time. And it was true in the past, in the 60s and 70s, in that era, that the Flint River was fairly polluted. It was an unhealthy river. It had a lot of industrial runoff that was being shunted into the river. But since that time, various groups have worked to clean up the river and to reduce the amount of pollutants that go into the river. And today, the Flint River is actually a fairly healthy river, especially for one that runs through an urban area. It is there are areas in the river that there are eagles nesting. It's a beautiful canoeing river, and it's fairly healthy. So really, the river water is not the source of the problem. Yes, it is more corrosive, but the problem that Flint experienced and is still experiencing had to do from the fact that the water wasn't treated properly. Anti-corrosive agents were not added to the water, and that produced the current problem with lead in water that we have in Flint.
You think that there has been some misinformation about the condition of water in Flint, or at least the situation surrounding contaminated water. What sort of misinformation are you hoping to address with this exhibit?
Well, what seems to happen is you tend to have some figures, some of them national figures and not local, but even local figures, that will make statements that are inaccurate about Flint's water situation. For instance, I keep hearing over and over again that the reason we have problems with the Flint River is polluted. Well, that's not really the case. The case is that we have problems not because the Flint River water is somehow bad or it shouldn't be used as a water source, but the problems are because of corrosion and the fact that it wasn't treated to be anti-corrosive, which should have been done. So there are things like that that we hope to clear up in the exhibit so that people can be informed about what actually is going on, and so that when they hear something that's misinformation or maybe there's somebody that makes a statement that's incorrect, they can learn about it and find out what the actual situation is here from our exhibit.
We're talking about the new exhibit, Water's Extreme Journey, at the Sloan Museum in Flint. You can see it through May 8th. Our guest is the museum's executive director, Todd Slisher. The museum is also planning 13 public events in coming weeks around this exhibition. I don't necessarily want details about each of the 13, but am I right about that, that there are 13 events? They include lectures and children's programs all surrounding this new exhibition, Water's Extreme Journey?
Yes, absolutely. This is another thing that we wanted to do to help educate our community about water, water issues, about water filters. And so there are basically two types of public program. One is more aimed more at kids, and it's more of a hands-on program where they're either they're building a water filter or they're looking at pond water and what lives in them and all sorts of activities to deal with water. But the other part are public lectures meant more for adults that talk about our water crisis. We're bringing in the Flint Journal to do a panel discussion about the timeline of the crisis. Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha is coming in to do a talk about lead and its effects on kids. We're having a talk about the Karagani pipeline, which is the new water source that that was kind of the start of this whole thing. This Flint announcing that it was going to switch to a new water source, the Karagani pipeline that came from Lake Huron. And so we have a presentation on that and many other presentations wrapped around this exhibit. For all the details, people should go to our website, which is sloanmuseum.org, to find out all about those public programs.
Todd, I wanted to ask you about the news coverage of the Flint water crisis and the degree to which you can tell whether this has sparked interest in this exhibit. It may be too early to answer this question, I suppose, but are you hearing from people that they're looking forward to seeing this exhibit and learning more about the condition of the water system around Flint?
Yes, we are. Ever since we announced the exhibit, we've gotten a lot of feedback from people saying, oh, this is a great idea. We're so glad that you're able to do this for the city. People are excited to come see the exhibit and to find out more about the water situation and more about water conservation in general. So, yes, there's considerable excitement about the exhibit, and I anticipate that will continue as the water situation in Flint continues to evolve.
Yeah, and I think that there's enough interest in the water in Flint these days that you may see visitors from outside the city of Flint, too.
I wouldn't be surprised. I'm sure that there will be a number of national news outlets that continue to come to Flint to cover the story that will be talking about it. And so for that reason, we'll probably see people coming in from outside the Flint-Genesee County region that just want to know a little bit more about the situation.
The museum's promotional materials about this exhibit says, and I'm going to quote from it here, it empowers visitors to take action, commit to clean water, and express their support for clean water initiatives. This seems to be especially important these days.
Yes, yes, it really is, both, you know, from the standpoint of the Flint situation, but just all cities in general, and in general, clean water is an issue countrywide. You know, out west, they don't have very much clean water. Here in the Midwest, we're kind of blessed with the Great Lakes as a water source and clean water, but it's still an issue even here in a relatively clean water area of the country. So all over the country, conservation of water is important. It's important that we don't pollute our watersheds and that we can maintain clean, fresh water.
Water's Extreme Journey is at the Sloan Museum in Flint through May 8th, and considering the city's current crisis with contaminated water, a museum exhibition couldn't be more timely. We've been talking with the Sloan Museum's Executive Director, Todd Slisher. Todd, thank you.
Thank you very much.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Friday night in Grand Rapids, the Kent Philharmonic will have a one-night-only benefit concert at the Cathedral of St. Andrews in the city's downtown. Current State's Jamie Paisley visited with the Kent Philharmonic's music director to talk about the concert and about the world premiere that's on the program. Hi, Jamie.
Hey there, Mark. Yeah, Dr. Libor Andras is indeed a busy man, and although he is the music director of the Kent Philharmonic, well, for one of the pieces on Friday's benefit concert, Dr. Andras won't be on the conductor's podium.
I guess I'm one of the privileged ones to be able to maintain my craft, and that is viola. I started as a violin major. I should probably not say that for violists. I started as a violin major, did my undergraduate in violin, and then switched to viola and just enjoyed the ride tremendously, you know. I think the decade of viola jokes are over now, so I can just come out and say it. I'm proud violist.
Particularly as the piece that you're going to be performing in, it was Mozart was a man who preferred the viola as opposed to the violin, yes?
That's correct, yes. I think most of the really distinguished composers, those that performed their own pieces too, preferred the view from the middle of the ensemble. And so there was Haydn, Beethoven himself too liked to play viola when they were trying his quartets, and Mozart did himself too. In fact, there was a speculation that this piece that we're performing, this Sinfonia Concertante for violin and viola, was sort of written for himself, but then musicologists proved that not to be the case. Regardless, I'm so privileged to be playing alongside with Dilana Jensen, a really, really distinguished violinist, that I had the opportunity to perform this piece about 2 months ago with. And she's just such an inspiration. I mean, she's got she's been playing violin since very early age, sort of a child prodigy, and has done it all. I mean, she's the silver medalist of the Tchaikovsky competition, recorded numerous concertos with Eugene Ormandy Philadelphia Orchestra, and performed all over the world. And it's so unique for us to have that opportunity here in West Michigan to have a person of that caliber, an artist, a true artist, inspiration for all of us to perform with us.
You are the music director, but you're not going to head up the concert. You have instead somebody that's very locally known. Who is going to be leading the concert?
Another great friend and great inspiration, person that has done so much for arts here in Grand Rapids and in West Michigan, an ex-maestro of Grand Rapids Symphony Orchestra, Mr. David Lockington, who is Dilana's husband and has graciously agreed to join us for this performance. And so he is going to be leading most of the pieces because David Isley dedicated this trilogy to me. I felt that it would really be an honor for me to present it. So that's the only piece I'm conducting in this concert. And the rest of it is going to be in hands of Maestro David Lockington.
Now, Dilana has worked with several great artists, and you have as well, including, if I'm reading correctly, Led Zeppelin. Is
Led
somebody
Zeppelin.
Else you've performed with or for? Or tell us about that.
Yes, definitely. I was hired for their World Reunification Tour back in Texas during my doctorate studies there to be sort of their background orchestra. At that point, they brought in a group of string players from India. This is after their spiritual journey. And so there were sort of three entities on the stage. And it was a very, very unique experience. And I would, if I was asked to, I would trade to be a rock player anytime. I'm telling you, the treatment you get, it's outstanding. No, but they were very, very interesting artists to work with. Very unexpected for me, coming from the classical, the serious background, to have a serious, deep conversations about world affairs, meaning of music, and all those things with rock musicians. So that was it was a thrill, and I put it on my resume because I think that was a very unique experience for me.
Now, for the Ket Philharmonic, the members of that orchestra, different. They're not rock members, but they're who are the people that make up this orchestra?
Right. I do have to say they all rock, though. They come from different walks of life. We have music educators. We have people that have done performance degrees and went on to do something else. And we also have students. So it's a true community ensemble that brings musicians from different walks of life with one specific task or dream. And that is make music, have good time doing that, and share that with community.
That's Dr. Libor Andras, music director of the Kent Philharmonic, who will have a benefit concert this Friday evening, with the proceeds going to the Grand Rapids Community College Music Scholarship Fund. In addition to the Mozart Sinfonia Concertante, as well as Handel's Zadok the Priest, both of which will be guest conducted by David Lockington, well, Dr. Libor Andras will himself conduct a world premiere piece written by an old friend of his.
I'm David Clark Isley. I'm coming here to hear the premiere of a piece I wrote primarily for the conductor, for organ and orchestra. Not to be confused with orchestra and organ, it is for organ and orchestra.
The name of it is Trilogy, which gives, to my mind at least, knowing what I've read about you, you do a lot of liturgical works.
Mm-hmm.
And so is it the Trilogy, is that supposed to be a reminiscent of the Trinity, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost? Or is it more of, with an organ and orchestra, more of a concerto, that three-form trilogy of fast, slow, fast, that old style of concerto?
You're rather right on both counts. I do a lot of liturgical writing. So it might sound kind of liturgical in its nature, but it is a three-movement work.
But a three-movement, is it a concerto? Would you classify it as a concerto?
It is not a concerto. It is a piece for organ and orchestra.
And along the lines of a spectrum of organ music, let's say we have an early start of the sound world, at least, early Bach, Sweelinck, going all the way through the more radical realm of Reich as four organs. Where along that spectrum would you think Trilogy would be placed?
It's an interesting question. I came into composition rather late. I was doing it all my life, right? Ever since age six. Not a prodigy. Just stuff, right? But once I went to Oberlin to major in voice, I really fell in love with the organ. And so I passed the piano proficiency test and took organ as though it were a major. And then when I finished my degree, I thought, I wanted to take organ more. I decided I liked organ so much, I would go to Southern Methodist University to study with the late Robert Anderson, who was an internationally known pedagogue for organ. And I kept on composing. And when I got there, they said, you're too advanced for us. So just do it on your own. I had never had a composition lesson until my last year there, my second year there. I got 2 degrees there. There was a composition contest, and Sam Adler came to judge it. And I won. And then I went off to Eastman. And I felt compelled then to write rather dissonant music, because that was the rage then. Everybody was writing dissonant stuff. And this is my first time taking a lesson, so I felt like I should do this kind of thing. Until I fell into a niche when I went to Notre Dame and began doing more liturgical stuff, and it had to be singable, right? And I remember one time, it was almost funny, I went to the International Organ Music Festival at Hart College. They had it for 10 years in a row. I was there once as a guest, once as a participant, and once for their final 10th big anniversary thing as a composer again. And I remember going to a hymn sing. I was sitting next to Vincent Persichetti and his wife, and they were singing contemporary hymns. And she leaned over to me and said, David, this hymn is totally unsingable. I laughed because it was. So I began writing music that people could sing and pieces that I liked to hear. So I'm hoping that tomorrow, I'm hoping that I like it, because I'm hearing it in my head, right? And I'm hoping in other words, some composers say they don't care if people like their music or not. I do. I mean, why would I write it? I would like people to like my music. So I write pieces that, now go back to your spectrum, I don't know where I am. I find now many composers are writing very listenable, attractive, contemporary music. I think that's where we're at. I think the pendulum has swung back.
With a different perspective on Dr. Isley's piece, Trilogy for Organ and Orchestra, again, the conductor for Friday's world premiere with the Kent Philharmonic, Dr. Libor Andras.
I've performed several David's pieces. In fact, I've actually commissioned him to write several pieces for my own use, for Viola d'Amore and for Viola. And we've recorded these and presented at different places. So I got to know David's pieces, and I know his strengths, and I find that this piece sort of brings many different traces into the foreground. Definitely one that is choral, because I feel like this is a polychoral piece. See, he stresses that it's piece for organ and orchestra, but he's not diminishing the role of the orchestra. Orchestra is playing important role in this piece, as it sort of, it's a dialogue between the two instruments, if you will. And so I hear lots of polychordal material that like in the second movement states, I call it a hymn. I don't know if it is, David, but I call it a hymn. It's a beautiful, tangible melody that gets passed around, from different section of the orchestra as well as the organ. So I think that the audience will find something that will remind them of something they're familiar with, so they'll be able to relate it. And yet it's so new, so unique. It's contemplative. It's sort of open and. I'm really looking forward to try it in the space tonight for the dress rehearsal with this magnificent organ. So I think it's going to be also orally satisfying. That is going to be a magnificent big sound.
Typically, Dr. Andras and the Kent Philharmonic perform at the Royce Auditorium in Grand Rapids. However, in order to accommodate this world premiere of Trilogy for Organ and Orchestra by Dr. David Clark Isley, Friday's concert will instead be heard in the gorgeous acoustics of St. Andrew's Cathedral in downtown Grand Rapids, and performed by Nick Palmer, the regular St. Andrew's organist as well. Also on Friday's benefit concert is Handel's Zadok the Priest and Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante for Violin and Viola, with soloist Delana Jensen and Kent Philharmonic Music Director Libor Andras under the direction of guest conductor David Lockington. More information about the concert helping the Grand Rapids Community College Music Scholarship Fund can be found online at kentphil.org. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. What a January it has been in the state of Michigan. Tomorrow on Current State, our month in review with senior Capitol correspondent Tim Skubick and the Detroit News, Jonathan Osting. Also, a live music Friday, Sally Potter joins us to perform and talk about the Midwinter Singing Festival. Hope you can join us Friday here on Current State. All of our segments are at WKAR.org. Check them out. We'll see you Friday. It's Current State on WKAR.